We are in Matthew chapter 24. It's perhaps the most prophetic portion of the New Testament. Chapter 24 and chapter 25 is called the Olivet Discourse. The Olivet Discourse is a three-point sermon. Verses 1 through 14 is referring to the end times as it pertains to the Gentile world. Verses 15 to 36. This has to do with the end times as it relates to Israel. Verses 37 through 42, that's the end times as it relates to the church. So let's focus on verses 15 through 36, the end times as it relates to Israel. Are you ready? Go ahead and join me there in verse 15, Matthew 24. Therefore, when you, Israel, see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, and write in your margin there, Daniel 11, verse 31. That is a strong Jewish idiom or reference. The abomination of desolation would have little meaning to any other culture aside from the Jews. Whoever reads this, let him understand. What does that mean? That means, Harvest, we are supposed to get this one right. For those who know Israel's past and central place in Bible prophecy, this mentioning has deep, deep meaning. Hold your finger here. Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 is so specific in its details, it's absolutely astounding. 400 years from the book of Malachi to the opening of the book of Matthew. And many have referred to this intertestament time as the silent 400 years. How many of you guys know that God is never silent when it's important? And in Daniel chapter 11, the Lord tells Daniel through the angel Gabriel, he fills in all of those 400 years. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Are you in Daniel chapter 11? Join me there in verse number 21. After talking about all the Ptolemy kings there in Egypt and the Seleucid kings that are north of Israel in what would be the Assyrian Empire, he goes through, does the angel, exactly what those kings are going to be up to. Very specific. And then starting in verse 21, the Bible is going to focus in on a specific fellow. His name is Antiochus the Fourth. He's a person of real history. Now, as we read Daniel chapter 11, keep in mind that Antiochus is about 350 years away. Daniel is going to prophesy exactly what this guy is going to do. Let's check it out. Verse 21. There shall arise a, say it with me, vile person. If the Bible mentions you, that's one thing. But if the Bible adds the moniker vile, this is a bad, bad dude. Write in your margin here, Antiochus the Fourth. And check him out on Wikipedia or any place that you want. He's a real person. And the Bible is going to prophesy exactly what he's going to do and when. Shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. Antiochus gets to the throne, surpassing his brother who was the rightful heir and has him murdered. He wasn't king by royalty or royal and proper lineage. He was made king by his own intrigue and murderous rage. And the fellow who he used to murder his brother, guess what? Antiochus the Fourth has that guy murdered too. But he, Antiochus the Fourth, shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. The book of Daniel in another location says, this is what the Antichrist is going to do. By peace, He will destroy many. Antiochus is a real person in history, about 170, 180 BC. He's a real person that God allows to steamroll right over the nation of Israel. You want to know what happens? Check it out, verse 22. With the force of a flood, they shall sweep away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. This is a direct prophecy of a high priest in Israel by the name of Onias Pius III. Verse 23. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. This is prophesying that Antiochus is going to roll into Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem at this time, there were two strong cultures in effect. There were Jews that sort of moved away from their Jewish roots, and they embraced a Greek culture. They dressed like the Greeks. They had the tennis shoes of the Greeks. They were known as the Hellenistic Jews. And Antiochus IV allies with them and uses the Jews who were Hellenists to destroy the temple-loving, law-abiding Jews in Jerusalem. And boy, does he wreak havoc. And here's Daniel telling us all about it. Verse 24. And he, Antiochus IV, shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder and the spoil and the riches. He's talking about Israel is plundered. And Onias' brother is the one who murders Onias, because Onias' brother is in cahoots with Antiochus IV. And how did he raise a high bribe? Onias' brother, Menelaus, he stole gold and silver artifacts from the temple, pawned them, and gave a huge sum to Antiochus IV. That's prophesied right here. Plunder and spoil and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds. For only a time, he's going to swing down into Egypt where the Ptolemy boys live, and he is going to see a certain defeat by an upstart little seafaring nation by the name of Rome. And on his way home, defeated, tail between his legs, he takes out his great wrath on the people of Jerusalem. Verse 31. For ships from Cyprus, and if I had time, I would show you in your history books and give you the name of the Roman admiral that this takes place. And ships from Cyprus, Roman ships, shall come against him, Antiochus IV. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant, that is to say, Israel and Jerusalem, and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant, right in Hellenistic Jews. Verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. And then shall they take away the daily sacrifices and place there the, say it with me, abomination of desolation. Right in your margin there, 167 BC. This actually happens. Daniel, writing a little over 500 BC, is prophesying something that's over 350 years away. Let me tell you what happens. So there's Antiochus IV. He got routed by the Ptolemies, who have been reinforced by the Romans. Tail between his legs, he heads back up through and stops by Jerusalem. He gets all of the Hellenistic Jews on his side. And then he begins to systematically murder over 100,000 Jews here in Jerusalem. He defiles the brazen altar by offering a pig there, and that's a non-kosher animal. And then he takes the blood from that pig and he paints the inner walls of the temple, the holy place and the holy of holies. But he's not done. He places a statue of Zeus, the great Greek honcho god. And he places that statue where? In the holy of holies. Oh, it's a terrible day. It's a day that lives on in infamy way more than December 7th, 1941 weighs in our culture when Pearl Harbor was attacked. It shaped us forever. And this abomination of desolation lasts for about two and a half years. Verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, these are the Greeks, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God, they're going to be strong. And there's going to be a remnant. And they will carry out great exploits. Who's this? Right in your margin here, the Maccabees. Get out your history and read the tremendous story. Matthias and his five strong sons lead a guerrilla warfare and finally oust the Greeks in 165 BC. They secure and seize the temple on December the 25th in our calendar, the 25th of Kislev in the Jewish calendar. And so, yay, the temple is back. Let's rededicate this temple, which they begin. And they light the seven-branched lampstand. It wasn't a candlestick, it was a lampstand. There were seven bowls, and there were wicks that were trimmed in this bowl filled with a certain kind of oil, a Levitically manufactured, ceremonially pure oil. Well, here's the rub. When they got there, there was only enough fuel in this menorah to last for one day. So they looked around all the cupboards, couldn't find any more. So they began the task of making Levitically correct, ceremonially pure oil. But that takes a while. It takes about 8 days. And as the menorah burns day one, okay, we should run out of fuel. Day two, it's still burning. Day three, still burning. Are you serious? Day four, until finally the new oil is done and it is poured in, and the miracle of the dedication of the temple from the Greeks by the Maccabees, and the day that the menorah is restored with its full portion of oil, those 8 days are celebrated as miraculous, and it's referred to as the Feast of Lights. You know it today as the Hanukkah. 165 BC. 2 years in front of that, Antiochus IV did that awful thing, killed all those people, defiled every piece of furniture in the holy place and the courtyard, and put a statue of pagan Zeus in the Holy of Holies. That was maybe one of the blackest days in Jewish history, aside from when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple all those years in front. And that awful day still lives in the ethos and the understanding of the Jewish culture. Now let's head back to Matthew. Now that we know what the abomination of desolation is, do you understand that Jesus referring to it is not referring to it for the church's sake? Is not referring to it for any of the other nations' sake? This section is uniquely to the Jews. The abomination of desolation is a Jewish idiom. Steve, why are you breaking a sweat over that? Here's why. Because in a moment we're going to encounter a verse that says, the elect of God. And if you don't know the history and the strong central place that Israel plays in Bible prophecy, you will miss that and think that those are referring to Christians and the church that is going through the 7-year tribulation, the 70th week of Daniel. No, it is not with great respect. Verse 16. Now, when you see this abomination of desolation, that will not be a mystery to the Jews. The Antichrist, whom they embraced as their Messiah. Why did they do that? Because he was the one, through his political savvy, his economic strength, his military advantage, he's the one, the Antichrist, is the one who finally settles the Middle East peace process. He's the one that says, enough, makes a covenant with Israel for guess how long? 7 years, just like Daniel prophesied. And the Jews are so overwhelmed that they have peace in the region, wow, they pull down their security fence. Because we know that the Islamics are not going to come after us anymore because they'll have to deal with this juggernaut political steamroller that no one can deny. Daniel also said, that's going to last for about 3.5 years. And then something happens in the mid portion. The Antichrist changes his mind. Instead of letting the Jews worship their Jehovah, he says, uh-uh. And then the Antichrist himself will put a statue of not Zeus, but a statue of himself. And anyone who doesn't bow down and worship when the band plays, off with their head. Didn't that happen in Babylon with Nebuchadnezzar? It sure did, another model. So at the midpoint, all bets are off. And the Antichrist says, I want everybody to worship me and me only. When that happens, verse 16, then let those who are in Judea. How many have Judea in your Bible there? Does anybody have Fernley? Anybody have Sparks or Washington, D.C.? Joshua chapter 15, Judea, or the tribe of Judah, was where God said, that's where I want you to settle. And where is Jerusalem? Within the region of Judea. This is speaking of Jews and Israel. Do you see that with me? Then those who are in Judea who see this abomination of desolation flee to the mountains. Right in your margin there, Isaiah 63 verse 1. These mountains are Bozra. B-O-Z-R-A-H. How do you say Bozra in its current designation? Petra, which is in southern Jordan. How many of you guys remember Indiana Jones and he's there with his dad? Do you remember at the end of the movie, they have to rescue Pop, opening from this narrow passage there, carved into the sandstone face is that beautiful sort of Roman architectural building. That's where the Grail is. Well, not really. I've been to the back of that little building and there's a hot dog stand in there. No, there's not a hot dog stand in there. But it doesn't go back very far. That area opens up to a whole city that on all sides are surrounding it mountains. You can only get to it through that one little narrow place about wide enough for a jeep to get through or horses single file. And I was there a number of years ago, and Pastor Chuck has been teaching this for years. Also, Chuck Missler believes this is where it is. And there's a number of very fascinating prophecies regarding Bozra and what God does there. When I was in Petra, our guide told us that there have been people over the ages who have been putting the MREs, meals ready to eat, and Bible tracts have been placed there. Why? Because there are many that believe that that's where the Jews are going to flee to. And you can only get there, as I said, horses single file, maybe a jeep. You can't get heavy mechanized weaponry in there. But then I used to think, well, what's the big deal? All you got to do is fly a helicopter over. Do your homework. By the time the midpoint of the Great Tribulation has started, there have been terrible judgments on the earth. And one of them, of fire and brimstone, could very well be thermonuclear activity. And if nukes go off in the upper atmosphere, what happens to the electronics within a 20, 30, or 100 mile radius? They get wiped out by what's called an electromagnetic pulse. When the Bible talks about horses, what a quaint notion. We know that World War III is not going to be fought with horses. What if the Bible is literally correct? And much of the mechanisms and vehicles have been rendered inoperative because of one electromagnetic pulse after another. And what if the Battle of Armageddon was in fact fought on horseback? And also, that would limit aircraft from going over this area that can shelter adequately over a million humans. Those are in Judea, not Fernley, not Washington, D.C., not Moscow. Jews flee to the mountains, possibly Basra. Verse 17, let him who is on the housetop not even go down to take anything out of his house. Get out of town right now. Verse 18, let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Why is everybody running so fast to get out of town? Let me show you why. Revelation chapter 13 fills us in on what happens after the midpoint of the Great Tribulation. Chapter 13, verse 1. You have seen six seals pop. You are in a parenthetical section of the book of Revelation. We are now in the midst of what's known as the seventh seal. The seventh seal contains seven trumpet judgments. And then the seventh trumpet judgment contains seven bowl judgments. And there are reasons for that, but let's check it out, chapter 13. We are at the midpoint of the Great Tribulation. A quarter of the earth has been killed, and then a third of the earth has been killed, and the Antichrist has run roughshod over every nation. But something's happening to his kingdom. And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns. Right in your margin there, Daniel chapter 7, verse 24. We know who this character is. This is the representation of the last world empire that the humans will ever command. And this is the Antichrist in model form. And on his horns, ten crowns, and on his head, blasphemous name. Verse 2. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion. If you've been with us in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, we know who this is. These are the world empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and then Greece. But if you're savvy, you'll notice leopard, bear, lion. In Daniel chapter 7, it was lion, bear, leopard. Why are they in reverse order?